From Beyond Marketing, it's the 20-Minute Call, a podcast about the dreamers, boundary pushers, rebels, and champions of the skydiving industry. Each episode is a narrative journey highlighted by the highs, lows, and luck that the skydiving industry delivers, as told by the most influential people within the sport. If you've ever dreamed of becoming a skydiver, perhaps opening a drop zone, or becoming the next world champion, check out the 20-Minute Call hosted by me, James LeBarry. For my introduction today, I'm going to slow it down because there's so much packed in this man's life that it could be overlooked. Today, I have the honor of being joined by a true legend in the world of skydiving, Craig Sarge Girard. Born in Tempe, Arizona, Craig made his first jump on March 14th, 1981 at Sky High Pioneer DZ in Phoenix, Arizona, and has since accumulated over 32,000 jumps. His illustrious career spans more than four decades, and he has won numerous awards and championships, including the U.S. National Champion 8-Way for an impressive, get this, 18 times, and U.S. National Champion in 4-Way 6 times. Craig's success in World Cups is equally outstanding, securing 5 8-Way championships and 2 4-Way championships. He is also a 2-time World Games champion, a 4-time Body Flight World Challenge Tunnel champion, a 6-time world champion in 8-Way, and a 2-time world champion in 4-Way. He's a former U.S. Army Golden Knight, a longtime member of Arizona Airspeed, and the chief freefall instructor at Skydive Dubai. Craig's achievements also include being a key member of the 300, 357, and 400-way large formation world records. His influence on the sport earned him a place in the International Skydiving Hall of Fame. Whether flying with the Golden Knights, leading Airspeed's 8-way team, or coaching the next generation of world-class teams, Craig's influence on the sport is truly unparalleled. Welcome to the 20-Minute Call, Craig Girard.
Thank you, James. Good to chat with you.
Does that intro get old for you?
No. No, but like sometimes you know, when a lot of times when somebody asks me for a bio, sometimes I'm like, it's like, I don't want to list some of those things, but I'm like, but it is kind of necessary because I'm not a young man anymore. And it's like worked a lot of years to do all that stuff, but I feel like I'm still kind of trying to add a couple more of those things on there without trying to add more stuff on, you know?
I guess you're used to being you, but do you feel like, dang, done a few things?
I'm really proud of what I've done, but also I'm really proud to just still be jumping and have had a really hard time imagining not jumping. You know, and I'm at a place in my life. I just turned 58 years old on July 29th. And so, you know, I'm like, but my body feels really good. Like, I don't have all the normal cricks and aches, and like my shoulders are good, my neck is good, my back is good. No, like badly broken ankles. And so I just feel like I'm knocking on wood every day because I feel honored to be able to still jump and have fun and enjoy it. Although I'm probably because I'm not like training every single day, doing 10 jumps a day. And, you know, that definitely helps, you know, but, yeah, that's probably the thing I'm most happy about is still being able to have the freedom of my body and my brain and just to be able to go out.
But you know what's crazy, Craig, is you're like, oh, I'm 58 and I'm still feeling good. You just won a world championship. Like, I mean, it's not like, yeah, I'm 58, I'm sort of on the course way down. It's like still driving high.
That's true. And so I was on XP8 last year but also like a couple of my teammates, like Kurt Werner, he's 50. I think he's turning 57. Either he already has or soon. And BK, Brian Krause, BK is like 50 or maybe a little bit more, 51, 52. And so, you know, they say like 50 is the new 40s or 60 is the new 40s. I don't know. But I just know inside me, like when I was 30 or 40 and I saw guys that were 60, I was like, man, that's really old. You know, that's really old.
This is a further question. I'll lead with it then.
Yeah.
As far as I know, the only time you've hurt yourself was when you broke your leg on your second skydive.
Yep, jump number two. Broke my ankle.
What about your approach has allowed you to be so injury-free for so long? I mean, like, kind of beating the odds here without a twisted ankle or something.
Man, well, I've sprained my ankles a lot in my younger years, but, like, man, I'm really fortunate. James, I'm like, I wish I had an answer for that. One, I don't feel like I'm really pushing it super hard all the time. Like, a lot of times, like, I'm just doing 90s or, like, real, you know, 1-1 or 180s into landing. I'm not doing anything high speed. And the ability to walk is a superpower without a limp. Without a limp. And it kind of feeds into this memory I have. I remember when I was on the Golden Knights, I remember going to a Golden Knight reunion. This was years ago, and it was all in, you know, Fayetteville, North Carolina. And I mean, this is every 2 years, old Golden Knights come back. And they had a lot of members of the original, the Strack team from the Golden Knights. It was like the first Golden Knight team from like 1959, something like that. And they made this really big welcome and had them walk up to the stage. This is when everybody was jumping round parachutes. Every one of those guys had a limp, you know? And so for me, it's like, I want to make sure that I take really good care of my landing gear, you know, because I feel like it's a really vital part of staying in the sport.
It's interesting. When I first came into the skydiving community, Pops was like, yeah, that's old people, Pops. And now we're seeing skydivers over 60 cranking out some skydives.
Yeah.
It is a new era. I mean, it's like skydiving is suddenly like golf. You can be older and...
maybe they'll have a master's league pretty soon, Masters World Championship or something like that, you know? Actually, you know, James, they just did the Hutter way of like with guys skydivers over 60, you know? Mm-hmm. You probably don't see that until you're that age, you know, because before I did it myself. I was just like, Pops, that's old, man. Now I'm thinking 40 seems kind of young for me.
Your resume only highlights your accomplishments, but what we don't hear about are the learning lessons. Some may call them failures to get to the tallest step on the podium. Can you share a struggle that you endured that was key to propelling you forward?
Man, I was a slow learner, you know, It's like, I don't know if I had too many like major issues because I started jumping when I was 15. And, you know, when you're 15, you're kind of bulletproof, you know, you think you're like dying happens to other people. And I don't know if this goes into like the competitive side, but like I don't know if I've told you this story, but I started jumping when I was 15 in like 7 months, and then it was March, and then my birthday was July, and sometime when I was 16, the guy that was my instructor had this great idea, because he had done this in the 70s, a guy rode a unicycle, did a jump, rode a unicycle, and so he wanted to kind of combine it where we could like jump with the unicycle. Have I told you this story?
No.
No. Wow. Okay. I thought, man, that's a great idea. So I started riding this unicycle every day. And like I would like, my dad had an old car out in front of the house, and I would like get on top of the car and ride it off the car to land on it. And just doing lots of repetitions riding this unicycle. And my dad was jumping with me. Now I look back on it, I probably had 200 jumps. You know, it's like 150. Thinking about it now, it's just ridiculous. Sounds so stupid, you know, that I made three jumps with a unicycle. So on the third jump, I had this brilliant idea because I was originally was jumping with a parafoil. It was a 252 square foot parafoil. And like I was going to try to like shoot accuracy, which I had no idea how to do. I was just going to, you know, because it landed softer, not just, I would land and cut it away and ride the unicycle away. And so we were going to try to do it for a show called That's Incredible. It was a show in the 80s. It was big on TV. And I just couldn't like land it without forward movement. So I couldn't stay on the unicycle. So we had this genius idea to land it with like a big paracommander. Like it's a round parachute that comes straight down. And I was light. I was like, I don't know, probably 135 pounds. I got out of the plane on the unicycle, 5,000 feet, and had a ripcord and had a horse, like I had a pilot chute went under the unicycle and just wasn't good. And so I ended up pulling the reserve really low. And so, and for the first time in my life, I figured out that dying could happen to me. And it's like, before that, I thought dying happened to other people. You know, I'm like, you know, I'm not doing anything dangerous. I think that's kind of stayed with me for a long time. Even though I've done a lot of things that like people would think, like a lot of base jumping and things like that. But, you know, I think there's one part of your brain that kind of keeps you from just doing something reckless, like super reckless. But as far as mistakes, man, James, I made so many. I think they're mistakes that you learn from, not something that like they're going to stay with you forever. You know, it's like, I think anytime you do any kind of a team event, it's all like a place to learn more and to get better. And you see that amongst your teammates. And I think the Golden Knights really did a really good job with that with me. Like I was really young when I got on the Golden Knights, and they're not so concerned. Like military is not so concerned about hurting your feelings. You know, if you're doing something there, they're on you. And I think some of those mistakes I made and being in the military was, I think it was a great environment to kind of keep you on the right track.
In all your years of competition, is there anyone that, and it didn't have to be necessarily even in your discipline, but is there anyone you would have liked to have competed with or against that you didn't?
Wow. We know all my heroes, like when I first started jumping, before I got in the Army, were like Mirror Image and the four-way Golden Knights. And when I got on the Golden Knights, one of the guys who won the world meet in 1981 was Andy Gerber. He was my team leader when I got on the Golden Knights. And then Bob Finn was his teammate on the four, and he was my golden, like when I went to Golden Knight tryouts, he was the cadre. He was like part of the instructors that chose you. And so those two guys, like I actually got a chance to jump with Andy and win a world championship with Andy. But there's a lot of guys like BJ Wirth and like Mike Michigan. There's like a lot of the guys from Mirror Image, guys from Visions, Coors Team. Those are guys that like I really idolized, you know, growing up, and never even considered myself to be in that circle. Been competing since 1988 was like the first year I was on the Golden Knights competing with them. I've had a really amazing opportunity to meet a lot of those guys, and I've had chance to like jump with them on various events, like big ways we've had, or like the world record, like the 400 way, 357 way. And so all those guys, they're inspiring, because I just remember just wanting to be like them and to do what they're doing, and I'm still really good friends with a lot of them. As far as somebody current man, I don't know. Like, there's a lot of guys that I'm still really good friends with, and probably the only reason why I couldn't is because we're on different teams. You know, like to just be on a team with a lot of the Golden Knight guys. You know, and I was like with Matt Davidson and Brian Krause. We were teammates last year on XP, but there's a lot of guys in other disciplines that I'd like to be teammates with, you know, like Rook Nelson. I really dig Rook Nelson, man. He's an amazing guy, man, and an amazing skydiver, but like we've never had a chance to be on the exact same team, but you know, we're really good friends and Rick Nelson probably be one of those guys that comes to mind right now. Yeah.
Yo, a quick break here to address the Drop Zone owners listening to the pod. If you're a DZO, then you know the insanity of taking your passion and making it your business. Why'd you do that? Running a DZ is hard. Between the stressors of liability, 30-day payment terms on fuel after 4 weeks of miserable weather, and angry staff who are convinced they've been skipped in the rotation, you need a tool that helps reduce your stress. Enter Burble Software. Conceived by a DZO who's been in the trenches just like you, Burble is the most sophisticated manifest and booking software on the planet. Your life as a DZO is hard enough, so don't be that DZO who tries to save a few bucks using software that wasn't built for us. Burble, the must-have drop zone management software for the 182DZ to the multi-turbine monster. Burble. Craig, you said you were kind of a slow learner, but your accomplishments are off the charts. But, you know, a lot of top competitors, say, let's take Tiger Woods. Killer instinct.
Yeah.
Do you have a killer instinct?
I like winning, but I like competing more. Mm. And I know a lot of people, I don't know how they imagine me, but it's like I really enjoy the whole process of training, but I really enjoy the process of competing, because I remember reading a quote and it's really clung to me. It's like learning to love the fight more than the win. I'm an 8-time world champion. Out of all of those are just the ones that I won. You know, there's a bunch that I got silvers, you know, or some other medal. My two favorite medals were both silver, and they were the best competition I ever had. Like in the 8-way with the Russians in 2003, we went to round 10, tied up, went to round 11, tied up. And at that time, the rules were whoever had the highest scoring round out of all of those, that's who got the decision. And so we finished 11 rounds, had the exact same score, and we got a silver medal. That, to this day, is my favorite 8-way medal because of the fight. And the same for the 4-way in 2010. We were in Russia fighting it with the French. The lead exchanged a bunch of times, and in round 9, it was totally tied. In round 10, we thought we had our best ever. It's like, beat that. And those guys did it. They probably had one of the most perfect jumps I've ever seen. And it was really easy to just go shake their hand and celebrate with them and enjoy that, because that's what I like the most. When it's super tight the whole time and you're still good friends with your competitors, you know, like there's never like a, you know, like trying to scare them. Like I watch a lot of UFC and I see a lot of those guys when they're in the, they're doing their interview before the fight. They're like, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to murder you. It's like, man, that just doesn't, I don't see myself like that. But also it's not like you're going over to their house having dinner with them in the middle of the competition. Everybody's always friendly, but everybody wishes each other a good competition. But I think when you have that, and I don't know if too many people have had that, I think what you're doing is you're earning more fans. And like the people who are really paying attention are just like, oh, man, this is so exciting. And there's been a lot of those competitions where it's like the lead is so big that it's like, after round 4 or 5, they're probably already like, okay, let's go watch something else with a fight in it. And I'm kind of like that with all sporting events, you know, whether it's like we were just kind of watching the women's soccer, you know, yesterday, my wife and I, Eliana, you know, a lot of times I don't really care what the sport is. I just want to see a good battle, you know, it's exciting.
I watched that match too. You know, I'm always impressed. You know what impresses me the most is how athletes respond to loss.
Yeah.
Not necessarily how, like, it's easy to be a good winner, but to be a great loser. And I see this in tennis a lot. I think it was Djokovic in Wimbledon finals losing and still having, like, he lost Wimbledon in the final this year and being such a class act. And,
yeah.
I look at that and I go, man, the admiration I have for people in the face of defeat. My question, Craig, is, and you're a great champion, the most decorated champion, but you're the best sportsman.
Thank you.
Where does that come from?
I don't, you know, James, I wish I could say one thing that did it, but I think it's also winning and losing and then re-winning. And so, you know, there's a little bit of a cycle in there, because I remember after I won my first world championship, I just didn't want to lose. I was nervous, man. It wasn't super enjoyable for me. You know, I was like, even though we won this world championship, when I got done, I was just like, whoa, gosh, thank God that's over. And then after doing more and more competitions, I realized that you will never have many opportunities to feel like this and to be excited about it and to enjoy it. And just having some opportunities to win something big, lose something big, and re-win it again. And I don't think that's a required cycle that everybody has to go through. But if you're going to win a world championship and then walk away, that's no problem. But sometimes when you win something and you're the guy that everybody wants to beat, I think everybody, to really be a complete sportsman, you have to stay there, not say that you're going to let somebody, but that's what people keep pushing. And it's hard to stay there at the top. And when somebody does, they're using you as a measure. And when it gets close, you can feel it. And then the time that somebody does beat you, you got to remember how that felt. You know, and to be a good example of a human being and a sportsman, how you react to this, to somebody or a group of people who just used you as an example and then beat you, which it is competition. And a lot of people, they say, well, I don't compete unless I can win. Well, that's called an award ceremony. That's not a championship. If you know you're going to win, that's not competition. There has to be some element of risk in there. And the people who do beat you or are better than you on that day, it completes how they feel the way you act. And James, that's a really, really big question. It's like people don't, I don't think people can just plan of, if I'm going to lose, this is how I'm going to act. I think that it, without trying, you have to win something and lose something and just take those feelings and kind of understand them, you know. Mm-hmm. But also how, I think when you win and how people treat you, the people that you just were better than, I think that plays a large part in how you're going to make the other people feel. Because ultimately, it's a 1 or 2 day competition. But after you get done, it's like if you're a sore loser. And a lot of people don't know how to control their emotions when they're in a competitive field, because I feel like they see a lot of sports on TV and people have to be angry. And maybe that works for a lot of people, but it doesn't really work for me.
Have you ever felt, though, not everyone is a sportsman? Has there ever been a scenario where you felt like it was rubbed in your face a little bit, in a defeat where on the rebound is a little bit personal? Like, I really want to beat these guys.
It is, but it's like, I don't know, maybe it's just, I kind of recognize it's not about the team, it's about the individual. And I think a lot of times it's, they've got other things going on inside of them, you know, and other than just beating you. And maybe I'm saying this from being a 58-year-old competitor who's been competing for a long time. If I was a young person and that's the feelings I got from somebody, I probably wouldn't really know how to deal with it. I thought they would take it really personal. But because it's a team event, you know, it's not like an individual event where it's just one person against another person, you know? And so I think all of my success has been with team style events where you have camaraderie and, you know, like, unless somebody's trying to solo you out and like pick on you or something like that. But I mean, I have experienced some of that, but I think it's probably just, you know, immaturity, you know, stuff like that.
Let's talk about mental toughness, because you can be the most talented skydiver in the world, but if you can't hold it together, right? It's one thing like with you and, you know, the storied venture of Dan BC, we got to topple the French, you know, we want to get the guys at the top. But when you are the guy on the top and then maintaining that top position when everyone's trying to gun you down, it's like, how do you maintain the mental fortitude to stay present despite knowing that you're the target?
Yeah, that's a great question, James. And it's happened to me a lot, you know, and it's way harder to stay on top than it is to be everybody's looking place, like to be the guys to beat, you know. And, you know, it happened with me on Airspeed, it happened with me on the Golden Knights. And it's something that, like, you know, you have to in training, when you're not competing, you have to like have little games with the teams, like, so-and-so's training today and they're looking for our number, you know, but in a good way, using it as motivation. I think to have that, especially as somebody who's trying to win, it's almost like beating a dynasty. You know, it's like, I remember when I was on Airspeed, we were trying the Airspeed 8-way, we were trying to beat the Golden Knights. And, you know, they had won in everything from 1987 on. And we started that team, the 8-way team, in 1996. And we lost to the Golden Knights at the Nationals by like 2 or 3 points, you know. And we had pushed the average over a 20-point average. Like, we did things that had never been done and pushed the Golden Knights. And then those guys won the Nationals, went to the World Meet, and they won the World Championships in 1999, but had set a couple of world records and did some amazing stuff. And then we kind of had to regroup. And we're like, I remember we all were assigned a book, and it was by Pat Riley. It was called The Winner Within. And it was about the Lakers beating the Celtics and like beating a dynasty. And, you know, even though it wasn't the exact same thing, it had a lot of that same kind of how you see yourself winning and is it possible? And mostly just to have a common vocabulary amongst our entire team. So we all had a required reading. So we all read it. And, you know, we had a lot of discussions of quotes and stuff like that and what came out of it. And I thought it was really beneficial for all of us, you know, just to, and then in 1998, we ended up beating the Golden Knights and ended up going to what I meant to say was the 97 World Championship for the Golden Knights. We went to the 99 World Championships and won the World Championships. You know, a lot of times I think it's all here. It's mentally. And when you have a team event, it only really takes one person on that team to not believe it. To do really outstanding things, you have to get everybody on a similar kind of like, are we training enough? Are we capable enough? I mean, just to be able to see it go to that place.
Give me some insight, and I'm pivoting off of the mental toughness question. You've identified several skydivers that you look up to, and one of those names is Jack Jeffries.
Oh, yeah.
When I think of Jack, I think of someone that's very mentally strong and is now training the most senior C-level executives in the world. I imagine there's some crossover there, but share with me your thoughts. Why Jack Jeffries?
When I first met Jack, I wasn't even on the Golden Knights competition team. I was on the demonstration team, and I saw Jack, and he was training in Rayford in North Carolina for the 87 Nationals. And I've just been hearing his name a lot. And, you know, because we're similar kind of an age, like when we did first meet the following year in 1988, we were competing against each other, and Jack ended up taking first in four-way, and we took second in four-way. And we kind of bonded from that moment on, just as friends, and just seeing his evolution of becoming highly technical and sharp. And I think because he had a lot of like dysfunctional teammates, they invested a lot of time to have like a sports psychologist come in and work with them about instilling a lot of checks and balances in there to make sure that the team is operating together. And when I left the Golden Knights to come to Airspeed, those are the things that were new for me, you know, because on the Golden Knights, you know, you're all from the military and you kind of learned early on that it's a completely different environment than being on Airspeed, but any plan will win as long as there's a plan. And being in the military, there it's a different, it's like you just learn to listen to directions. You know, like there's no, you know, there's a leader. This guy is a leader based on rank or experience level. And so when on Airspeed, there was guys coming from all over. You got Dan BC, you've got Kirk Verner, you got Jack Jeffries, Mark Kirkaby. All these guys, you know, could be a leader. And so to get that group of guys to get on a team and have a structure where there was like a rotational leadership model. This is one of the biggest things I learned on Airspeed is like you're the captain for the week. And so everybody had to be a captain for a week. And like you're never as good of a follower as you are until after the week you've been the leader. And so you're making decisions on the jumps, on meet times, physical training, when you leave, final decision on all engineering. All those things are for the captain. And through that year of training, you're going to find out who you want to be the captain in a competition, you know? And so the group makes that. But what it does is it gives everybody a chance to lead and everybody have a chance to be a follower. But a lot of people, they are natural leaders who without any kind of change, they're just going to be in charge all the time. And it's, you know, the same boys. And so we really found that having a rotating leadership model was really important, not just for the people who weren't natural leaders. Sometimes the best advice comes from people who speak the least. And so it was game changing for me. And with Jack specifically, because I wanted him and I to be peace partners, and just had a fabulous time, and we're still best friends. And it's like the examples, and not just Jack, but Kirk and Dan and Mark, those guys were all very inspiring. But because Jack and I were peace partners, like we did a lot of hanging out and always held him in a high level just because he was professional. And, you know, the one thing that really impressed me with Jack is sometimes if you're going to give some critique and you're making the same mistake, you won't give the critique. And so Jack could actually make a similar kind of mistake, but still give the critique. And I was like, that's something that I really respected, because it's so hard to try to give some advice if you've just, you know, like to tell somebody you have to be on time and you've just walked in the meeting late. You know, it's like, but it's not what he's doing. It's like what's best for the team. And it's kind of funny because Jack and I and Eliana and Jack's wife, Orla, we just went on a cruise from Croatia for a week together in June. Yeah. But I still hold him at a very high place. And you know, he's obviously taken everything he's learned in skydiving and put it into the corporate world. And, you know, I've heard him say, he says, man, it's very much like coaching four-way. You know, it's a team event.
Craig, you're still in the thick of where it's all happening. As you look on the entire sea of competitors out there, is there a guy or a gal out there that you're like, the mark is on them? They've got all the ingredients to be a world champion. Is there anyone that's, wow, it's got your eye?
There's a lot. There's a lot, James, but it's the opportunity. you know, of, especially on a four-way team, because it has to be with the right people, but it needs really high-level sponsorship, you know. It's like Skydive Arizona, man, it's like one of the reasons why Arizona Airspeed has done so well. It's not just Arizona Airspeed. It's Skydive Arizona and the Hill family. Like, Skydive DeLand sponsored a lot of teams, and they've made a lot of world champions, you know. And so Skydive Paris sponsored a lot of teams. But to do it at that level, you know, there's a lot of people that have the makings of that. But to have that kind of environment, but not just Skydive Arizona, but like with sponsorship, you know, with manufacturers, you know, with everything, just to keep things moving and the support. And it's a big deal. Like right now with competitive skydiving, especially with the eight-way, it's been Russia, France, and the U.S. for so many years. And Russia obviously can't compete right now because of, you know, the Ukrainian war. And France is having a tough time too. I think they're trying to put together an eight-way team, but like Qatar has an eight-way team. There's a lot of people that fit that mold, but there's not so many teams that can make that opportunity happen.
It's amazing how much needs to come together. It's like,
yeah,
it's a business.
It's 100% a business. And it's once you do have that opportunity, which is like golden, then to not have a dysfunctional team, doesn't happen by magic, man. It is every day, like checks and balances, like having goal setting, having a pass the rock, having debrief captainship, resetting goals, and then start the next week. It didn't like just come in, just work Monday through Friday. And I think any successful team, whether it's a relationship, you know, friendship, or a work, like if you have an office team, but like a skydiving team, it's taught me so much that everything's a team. Everything. And it needs a lot of communication. And it's like, and it has to be like, you have to have a plan. Like, this is what we're going to do on Monday. This is what we're going to do on Wednesday. This is what we're going to do on Friday. And this is our, when I was on Airspeed, we typed them out. This is our preparation plan for walking. This is our creeping plan. This is our debrief plan. This is our debrief plan in competition. On goal setting plan, debriefing goals, and it's all written out. And so then we all had like a contract. It was called Contract for Working Together. And it was like, basically what it said was, if there's ever a point that the team feels like you're just going through the motions, anybody can be asked to step away. Like, that's, we did that. It's like, it's called the Contract for Working Together. And it's like, everybody agrees that like, if you're just like having a bad month and the team's going this way, it's like,
Craig, as you explain that, like, it's mind blowing, right? This is the stuff that most people don't know behind the scenes, but particularly in the era of the early stages of your career, say with Airspeed, where the culture of skydiving is, you know, like shut the fuck up and let's jump. Right? We're talking about mental toughness and reading Pat Riley's book and Contract for Getting Along. Like, you know, there's it's always been sort of a little bit ego fueled. I mean, that's a generalization that the people of skydiving are great. But, you know, when you describe what you're describing, most teams would need a manager, like a second pair of eyes that lets people know, like, hey, you're acting like a jackass with your teammates, but when you're in it, when it's subjective, you're not able to be objective. It requires so much emotional intelligence and self-awareness. It's amazing that you guys have been able to accomplish what you did with that level of emotional intelligence and self-awareness going through all of that, because there was no script for that.
No.
Maybe with the Golden Knights, I don't know.
No, I think this was... Airspeed had a psychologist, his name was Dr. Bob Moore, and he implemented some of these systems that we still use to this day. And the one biggest one that stands out to me, it's called Pass the Rock. And so what we would do, because we're training Monday through Friday is what we let's use that because that's pretty much what we did, 5 days straight. And when you're spending that much time together, there's going to be things that get on your nerves, you know, especially when you're tired. You know, you're getting up in the morning doing PT, and then you're training, and everything is just aiming for the best. With you've got, you know, 9 guys in there, and sometimes, you know, little things that are later on seem very insignificant, like they get under your skin. And combined with the rotational leadership model we had, this pass the rock is, we would have a pass the rock, which basically what it is it encourages listening, not talking. And so the rock could be anything, could be this pen. And like when you have it, nobody else can talk. But the first thing you want to do is start off with positives, things I like. And that's been a very big deal with Airspeed, positives first. Because a lot of times us as human beings, we go right to the negative. So you get to debrief like, oh, I sucked, or you sucked. And it's like, it starts from when you're breaking off from the jump. As you're breaking off, instead of like, oh, that sucked, you're like, what did I like? What did I like? What did I like? Because it changes the way your brain goes. So positives first. So when you have it, there may be something. Let's say we've already been training for like Monday, Tuesday. We have the pass the rock on Wednesday. And you're like, on Monday, I cannot wait until Wednesday because I'm going to bring this up. On Tuesday, you wake up and you realize it wasn't that big of a deal. But the ability to not get into that argument, then it saved me so many times. And if there's a problem, I'm just going to shelf it because on Wednesday, I know I'm going to have an opportunity. And then a lot of times on Wednesday, I'm like, so glad I didn't say something because it was not them, it was me. It's carried us all the way through. And we did it with our teams in Dubai, and we do it with our teams here. Like, we still do a pass the rock. And so if it's a weekend, we'll do it on one of the 2 days. And a lot of times, you guys, if you're not in a group doing something for an extended amount of time, it's not going to be anything significant in there. But when you have a group of people that are training, that is their one job. That's all you're into. It's like, that is so necessary to have that opportunity to think about what you're going to say. Say it calmly without trying to hurt somebody, because it's a learned thing. And, you know, that pass the rock, it's like anything in there, it's like you're going to get an opportunity because it's going to go around in a circle, that rock. And so when you let go of it and you hand it to the next person, if something was directed towards him, not to have a defensive reaction. It's so hard sometimes because you take it personally, but what you realize is I'm saying this to help keep the group moving in an upward, like growing. I'm taking responsibility for the team's growth. And if it's not for something like that, then you probably wouldn't be a great time to say it, unless it's something personal, like if I was late or if I was doing something that bothered you. It's a good idea to try to get that stuff out of the way instead of, you know, sweeping it under a rug and then talking about it with another teammate about what bothers you.
Craig, as I listen to you, it's like there is so much nuance. There is so much detail. You know, when I think about business and I work with, you know, some business owners and we talk about, okay, yeah, there's that thing that you do. In this case, there's a skydiving thing. There's exiting well. There's, you know, remembering all the blocks. It's, but that's just like 1/10 of it.
Yeah. A lot of it isn't about the skydiving. A lot of it's just interaction and how you are as a person. And a lot of times that person doesn't realize that is irritating or aggravating. And a lot of times people will just fire people they won't even find out why they're fired until later on. Having that pass the rock every week in the beginning, you know, it seems like there's big things, but you end up learning that nobody's trying to hurt you. Somebody's going to be honest with you so you can fix it, you know, or even if it's one person that it bothers that one person. But like the thing about pass the rock is it's about listening, because immediately you hear it, you want to defend yourself, but it's It's a learned skill to not be defensive. And I have to always remind myself of that, you know, because like sometimes it's not 100% of what they're saying. Sometimes you just understand they're trying to get something across and maybe they don't even really know how to vocalize it, but there's an intention in there that they're trying to get across. And it's like to not get your feelings hurt, but just to hear them and acknowledge it. And then you don't have the thing about the past rock. You don't have to have another discussion about it. And because there's nobody allowed in a past rock unless you're a teammate. So anything talked into there, it just stays in past rock. And when you walk out, everything's okay because you know you're going to have another one next week. You know, and then you could be like, man, I really like your improvement on that. That was awesome.
Team dynamics is such a huge thing, and it's clear that your systematic approach has worked, because if I were to ask you to name every teammate that you've jumped with through 40 years and still maintain that level of excellence, you know, like that's not by accident, clearly.
No. And James, I feel like with this conversation, those things that I learned on Airspeed, and those were from the four original guys, those were the guys that really kept that going, you know. So they're huge. And like talking with our team from Dubai, they were all kids. They're like 18, 19, 20 years old. And we had them goal setting on Mondays, debriefing goals, pass the rock, rotational leadership. They didn't realize it. Like Eliana and I were just in Dubai this last year, like we were there in May, and we were meeting up with a bunch of those guys, and they were like, man, you guys, we had no idea what you guys taught us, you know, because like they have other jobs, and, you know, this was their first kind of real job while they're going to school, because they were getting paid to be on the national four-way and eight-way team in Dubai, and then they're going back and working with people that haven't had any of that kind of structure. They're just like, wow, man. It's like I had no idea until now.
I feel like this conversation has been a masterclass for anyone wanting to get into formation, any kind of team.
Yes.
It is. That was so insightful. Let's pivot to story time, Craig.
Okay.
When you guys went to Dubai, you were gone for 6 years. And I'm not going to lie. As someone that has followed you for a long time, has had admiration for you and Eliana. When you guys left, I was kind of sad, like, because you were out of our focus. You guys were on winning teams. We got to see you at nationals every year. And then you went away. And from the outside looking in, it was like, wow, God, look what is happening in Dubai. I mean, the resources. And I think to myself, God, what pinch me moments did Craig and Eliana have over there between the resources that you saw, the people that you got to meet, sort of the, like, oh my God, this is so over the top.
Yes.
Right. And to me, I'll be honest with you, I was a little bit skeptical because I was like, man, all that glitters is not gold. And man, there's a lot of glitter. I'm not asking for the bad. I'm just sort of asking for, tell me the pinch me moments that I don't know about that was like, oh my God, whether it be the people that you met or the resources that you have.
There's a lot of pinch me moments in Dubai. But first, I will say this, James, that we didn't know what we were getting into. Like Omar Al-Hejlan called us and asked us if we would like to come there. We said, what would we be doing? He said, basically, we just want you guys to be yourselves, but do it here. I was like, that is the best job description I've ever had. And so it's like, and you know, at that time we had just done the 2010 World Meet, and you know, I know Eliana was the time, she was like, I had to talk her into doing 2010 because she was like, wow, man, it's a lot. And I was like, oh, let's do it again. And so, you know, as I said before, this was one of our favorite four-way competitions. So, and I had just turned 45 at that competition. And I was like, you know what, let's, whatever it is, we're going to do something together. And then Omar called us about this opportunity, and it was just the right timing. And so we thought, maybe we'll go, maybe it'll last 3 months. And if it lasts, you know, we'll be ready to come back. But we said, whatever we do, we're just gonna take some of that money that they're paying us, and we're gonna like make it work well for us. And so, because it had been a really long time before we had real jobs, you know, and so we had always, we could always make our own schedule. We would plan the next year out in advance, like all the camps. So we knew which days off we could take, or there was the first time we had real jobs. But one of the things that was amazing is there, when you say pinch me moments, all the time. Like there was, I don't know if there's been that level of support, like the Crown Prince of Dubai was, you know, it was much smaller at the time. We started working there when they had 60 people, and, you know, they're just, anything they needed, they would just get airplanes, build an airport, build a runway. I mean, but everything would go through SkyDive Dubai. Like anything new, it would be at SkyDive Dubai, and they're like, this person's here doing this. Do you want to try it? Like it could be anything, like any kind of carnival ride or something exciting. And there was, I can't even list them, but it was so exciting. It was so exciting. But I think anybody that went to the 2012 World Championship knows it was so over the top. I mean, they hired Katy Perry and Usher to play the closing ceremonies. You know, and then they hired Chris Brown like 2 days later. They told everybody, it was the highest attended world championship. I think it was like 1,500 or 1,600 competitors. And they said, we've got Chris Brown now playing after Usher and Katy Perry. And we'd like you guys to all attend. And if you can't change your tickets, we'll buy you new tickets. You know, it's like if you think of that, 1,500 people. Buy new tickets. Oh yeah, we'll house you for another couple of days in the hotel, which is like 5-star hotel. It doesn't happen anywhere else. I just feel like I'm going to be bragging if I say anything else. It's like so many things like that, because it's just like, and it started to become normal, you know, and it's not normal. And we didn't know how long it would last. We really loved our time there, loved it. But more importantly, we really liked our guys, loved them. Like our Emirati team, like we got them very young, like maybe one or two of them were jumpers, but we taught them to fly, you know, like we were their first instructors. They were making their tandems, and they got them from like horse racing clubs and like jockey clubs, and just, they're all great guys. And, you know, we were their only instructors. And so we had a wind tunnel, like a private wind tunnel there that we could just take them to. And, you know, they all flew exactly like Eliana and I. And Eliana and I have a very similar flying style, you know, because, yeah, we've been peace partners and worked together for a very, very long time. And so all of those guys, and I've heard a lot of people say that, they're like, man, those guys look exactly like you guys. And so we really enjoyed our time with them, and they actually did really well. And we had like, over that time, like 6 years that we were there, I think we ended up having like 15 different teammates on that team. But you know, that was our job. We basically went from being the competitors to teaching them, but although there was a lot of times that we were competing with them, it was amazing.
This podcast is sponsored by Beyond Marketing, the digital marketing agency for the skydiving industry. As avid podcast consumers ourselves, we're not fans of ads during a podcast, so we'll spare you the details about why we love building websites and helping businesses show up in Google search results. But just know this, we're passionate about the skydiving industry and how it markets itself. Look us up at dropzone.marketing. Again, that's dropzone.marketing. When you guys get back from Dubai, after 6 years of just whatever you want is there, nothing is too much, how do you adjust? How do you come back down to life in Casa Grande?
Well, you know, the one thing is the last year and a half or so, it was starting to taper down a bit. You know, like with the travel, you know, like they would say, it's not in the budget. I could feel it starting to like diminish a little bit, but still amazing. And, you know, it lasted for us. I mean, it's still going really strong for guys that are like tandem masters. You know, like there's still a massive amount of tandems going on there, like 200 a day, you know, and it's like, and a tandem is like $600. You know, it's ridiculous. And they're they're booked out. And so, but that time with all the competitors, like they sponsored all the teams, all the competitions. And so at the end, you know, we could feel it was, you know, diminishing. When we were feeling that, we were like, we had a kind of a feeling of it, you know. And so when it was time to go, they, you know, they basically let us know that, you know, we're getting rid of all the teams. Basically, just we're trying to focus more on tandems. But it's the only job I ever got, like a severance package. It's like, I got a severance package. It's like a very significant severance package on top, both me and Eliana, and on top of already just having just an amazing time, you know. And so it was, I wouldn't trade that opportunity. It was time of a life, and it lasted so long, and I have nothing but just amazing memories of it.
Craig, you get what you give. Of all the people that Omar could have called, it seems like an obvious choice to have called you. Through your career with Golden Knights, Airspeed, time spent in Dubai, you have met some major sports stars and celebrities, even a president in there, maybe two.
Yeah.
Was there anyone you met that really surprised you by how unique they were despite their celebrity status?
George Bush Sr. George Bush Sr. Yeah. And you know, like I've only met one president, and he was not an acting president at the time. He was, I remember his son was running for president at the time. This was 1999. And I just remember the first time meeting George Bush, BJ Wirth called us and asked Arizona Airspeed, because we had just won the world championship, to be part of his 75th birthday. And he called Passion 8 with Melanie Knatzer, was the, you know, the leader of that women's eight-way team. So they had both of our teams, and we were going to fly us to College Station, Texas, where George Bush's library is. Now it's a museum. And so I didn't know at the time that it's a library when you're alive and a museum when you die. So we flew the Skyvan there, and I'd never met George Bush or any other president. And a bunch of people went to go get rental cars and hotels, and we were waiting at the Skyvan on the tarmac, and this like a Gulfstream small jet comes taxing in, and it's George Bush and his wife Barbara, and they had like rolled out red carpet, and there was a bunch of press guys on the other side of the fence, and George and Barbara were gonna get down the stairs, walk on this rolled red carpet and do the interview, and we were standing by side the plane next, and we're just kind of waving at them, and George and Barbara Bush, they got off, they started walking down the carpet, and they looked over at us. We were waving at them, and they just turned left and came right at us. And I just remember I was like under the shade of the Skyvan, and like George Bush and Barbara Bush came walking up, and they're like, "Wow, we are so excited to jump with you guys." And like his eye contact and how pleasant and how not presidential and how not stuck up, and just like just a awesome guy. But like my mouth was probably open. I was just like, and he's the same height as me. He was 6'3", but just the most warm, open, you know. And then they went and did the interview. Like, oh, I can't wait to hang out with you guys. And later on, we did the jump with him, and then we went back to his library. It was just Airspeed, Passionate, and like some of the manufacturers. It was small. They closed the doors on the library and had a little bar cart, and it was just us with him and Barbara. And he gave us a tour of his museum, you know. And he's like, you know, this guy's been like head of the CIA. He was like ambassador to China. You know, he was president under Ronald Reagan for two terms. Like, this guy, he's probably forgotten more than we all know. And he was the nicest guy. James, by far, that's the top for me. Like, wow. And not even just he was a president, but just it's the way he made me feel. Mm. I think the one thing is, like, whenever you meet people, it doesn't matter what they, you know, how they think of you, how you look, it's how you make them feel.
Love that. What a great story. Craig, skydiving has taken you everywhere around the planet. Can you describe one of the most unusual or unexpected locations you've jumped and what made that experience stand out?
Well, you know, it's like I've had that question a lot, and I'm like, Dubai is pretty significant because even the normal drop zone is really cool. It's on the water, but during the competition, you're actually landing on the Palm Jumeirah. When I was on the Golden Knights, we did a bunch of training in Bermuda. I've jumped over the water. It's not just that. It's just, and I think if you ask anybody that has done a competition in Dubai, I think you're going to find a lot of similar responses. From altitude, that Palm Jumeirah, it's like maybe 5 miles tall, like top to bottom, and probably like, you know, 3 or 4 miles wide. But there's a strand of sand that goes around the outside that's probably a couple hundred, maybe like 300 meters across. But it's massive. And so you're landing on that. But when you break off from a jump and you're tracking out, you're just like, the visuals are unbelievable. They're just like, what? This is so cool. And then you land. This is amazing. And it's like, and then you're landing, and then you get picked up by the most massive speedboat. And you get in the speedboat, and they take you back to the drop zone in this. I mean, it's a crazy fast, awesome speedboat. I know that people want to hear something bigger and better, but not just scattered by competition, landing on the Palm Jumeirah, like up by the Atlantis Hotel. There's an Atlantis Hotel. It's up by the top. It's just kind of just to the side where you land, but I never got tired of that. I could just do that all the time.
I remember watching that, the 2012 World Meet, and I remember, you know, Regan was there and, you know, interviewing everyone. And I remember him interviewing you guys and the energy.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it was you almost hoped that that energy would never end with Dubai, because it was so exciting. Even if you weren't part of it, it was so exciting to watch it, and so excited for skydiving to be getting the love that,
yes,
you know, one would wish it would always get.
You know, they did so many things for the spectators, not just for the competitors. And most skydiving events are for the competitors. James, you remember this. They would give away like 20 iPhones or iPads every day. And not like when you came in, they would stop the competition. They'd have like a jet show. They'd have a aerobatic show, a paramotor show, a motorcycle show in between as fillers, because they would get so many people as spectators, you know, just to come watch the show. And everybody would get one of those tickets, you know, for like iPad and iPhone every single day. And like, people were just like holding on those tickets. They're like, okay, it's time to give out iPads and iPhones. And maybe they gave out more. It was a crazy amount of like high-end stuff to be given. Like, this is like the top of the line iPhone, iPad. And people out there, like, yeah, you know, getting their, winning an iPad, iPhone every day.
I have the biggest grin listening to that, because, gosh, it was like fantasy land watching that. It was.
Yes.
Oh, man, what a time. What a time.
It was. And everything was right there. Like, you know, like the swoop pond is like right in the middle of the land. Like, they have all the crowd was like right in the swoop pond. You know, it's like, and then they had all the skydivers landing on the Palm Jumeirah, where you could see them land, and then it just was a really cool place. And then they had like the accuracy landing, like, you know, I don't know if they, because they had so many competitions, I kind of get them confused, because a long time they had everything going on at the Palm. Then they started kind of moving them a little farther away, just so they, because the air traffic was really crowded. But what really got me was what they did for the spectator, you know. And even for that, they actually used our team with the first year we went there. I actually went there 2 years in a row, 2009 and 2010. And in 2010, they used a four-way image because we won the DIPC the year before, and we got to the airport, and our photo of us doing four-way was on every taxi cab, like all the whole city. Every taxi cab in there had that logo on it, and it was, you know, I've never been part of anything, but they really advertise it just to get not more skydivers, more spectators. And so, and they had like a Jumbotron. Remember that screen? That big old Jumbotron. And like, and they had like Reagan, like, who's amazing. Dude, he could keep things going. And they would bring like personalities in there. Like, I remember a lot of people would come in. Like, remember Felix Baumgartner had just like broke out. They brought him in there. And I mean, there was a lot of people like that for the competition, you know, but like just all the entertainment just for the spectators. It's a way to do it for sure. Hard Amazing. To replicate.
Amazing. I'm going to talk about something that isn't as fun, but it's a reality, right? Like, I'm about to turn 46. The way I view my time or my mortality is different now than when I was 26. I think about, getting up there, I there's a lot I want to do. You're just coming off another world championship.
Yeah.
But you led in this conversation early, like, I'm 58. Yeah. Right? Like, how are you dealing with aging, right? I mean, like, apparently we're going to have to start slowing down, though you are not. But do you think about that?
I do. And also, like, I realize that I don't want to jump every single day. I want to jump every single day. And I feel like and 10 days a month sounds perfect for me. 10 days a month to do something you really love. Because so many years I did it almost every day. And then, because we didn't make any money for a long time on Airspeed, so we'd have to do jobs to work. So we would train full time, and then all of our off time would be working to help pay the bills.
I have no idea. What work did you do? I have no idea.
Well, coaching, organizing,
okay, gotcha.
Organizing, tunnel flying, all those three things.
Okay, so you weren't working at Denny's?
No. And even like, I was a helicopter mechanic in the Army, but when I was on the Golden Knights, I didn't have to do that. But, you know, so it's been a very long time.
So how are you filling your time away from the drop zone? What are you into?
So Eliana and I, we just completed the Camino de Santiago. We hiked 500 miles across northern Spain. We actually went and did a 16-way tunnel camp in Abu Dhabi in that 32-foot tunnel. And on the way back, we took two pairs of clothes and like carried all of our stuff. And we had basically 2 months, let's say, to hike 500 miles. And it started in southern France. We hiked all the way to Santiago. This time we got an invitation, which I mentioned before, about sailing with Jack. So we ended up missing 60 miles of it. Okay. So we took a little break. We hiked like 300 miles. And then we got on a train, went to Madrid, flew to Croatia, went on for a week sailing with Jack and his wife Orla, and then we came back and finished the last couple hundred miles. It's kind of like that time, James, like not traveling with a rig, it's a big deal. You know, like we did so much traveling with a rig. And, you know, two pairs of clothes, because you're going to carry whatever's your house is on your back, and so you're going to carry it. So you got to think about your shoes. And Eliana and I had been planning this last couple of years, and then COVID happened, and then the XP invitation came, and I had it delayed another year. And so we were like, we're definitely going to do it. And so we trained for like, you know, several months doing hikes with the pack on, and we could do a whole nother podcast about that. It was amazing, to say the least. And it was like, had nothing to do with skydiving. And it's so similar to skydiving, because the thing that makes skydiving so great is the people. thousands of people, and you're on a journey. And so, like, we started in southern France, and with probably 150, 200 people, and you're going to see them along your journey. It's like starting high school as a freshman, and you're going to graduate together 500 miles later. And so you run into these people all along the way. And it was, you know, we averaged 14 miles a day, right? And every day, like, we would hike seven days, take a day off, hike 7 days. But we did have that week off to go sailing, which was amazing. And so, but it was so awesome to do that with Eliana. And we had brought headphones, and we just had an iPhone. We didn't bring any computers, just an iPhone. I think we'd have to, you know, listen to some something, because, you know, it's like a long time. And we never put our headphones in, not one time, not even one time. We're just cruising and just having a great time, listening to nature and just meeting a lot of friends. And the physical part of it wasn't so bad. It was just something you just get used to. And you know, it was a goal, like a long range goal. And so for us, we really enjoyed that, and more than I can ever explain right now. It's like, it just, not just the physical parts, just like just doing something really amazing together. And we want to go do more stuff, not exactly the same, but things like that. And so that's our search right now. But we still want to stay in skydiving, but like 10 days a month. I'm just throwing that. It could be 15, whatever, but like just as a place, and a help. I think that helps keep everything fresh.
Had you not joined the Army and become the most decorated formation skydiver in history, what do you think you would have done?
I wanted to be a helicopter pilot. And so when I was in the Army, I was jumping, but I just, the Golden Knights were like an astronaut. Like, I just didn't think it was possible for like normal people to get on the Golden Knights. I just, you know, I was like, I had like a couple of 100, 250 jumps when I joined the Army, when I left for the Army. And so they had no high school to flight school at the time. So I joined to be a helicopter mechanic. And my recruiter had told me that you can, you know, apply for flight school once you're in. And so I applied for flight school and the Golden Knights at the same time, after I met some ex-Golden Knights who told me, you should apply for the Golden Knights. And so I put both of those applications in at the same time. I had to take a FAST test, which is like a flight aptitude skills test. And it took a while to get that package together for like the Class 1 flight physical, and then the Golden Knights. There was an essay you had to write, which they used to choose. And so I put both of those in at the same time, and I said, whatever one comes back, if any of them come back, you know, probably do that. So, and then skydiving, just, you know, just no going backwards.
So if we're on a road trip together and the car breaks down, you are still mechanically inclined to open the hood and fix our car.
I just put three new motor mounts on this car. I have two cars here. I have a 2004 Mazda 3. It's got 250,000 miles on it. And then I have a Mazda Miata. It's got 180,000. Those are my two cars. And then I got my brother's car that's a 96 Mercury Sable. They're all three are working. My dad was an automotive mechanic and had a shop at our house. But I had a lot of time with a lot of dirty fingernails growing up working in the shop. And so I wanted to work on turbine aircraft where there's no like petroleum products, you know, it's all synthetic oils and stuff like that. So when you work on turbine engines or jet aircraft, if you see oil spill or something, it's not like black petroleum, it's all synthetic. And so that's, yeah, so I am a mechanic. Yeah.
Wow, I had no idea. You mentioned Miata. You told me a story last year about when you trained Michael Schumacher, and there's a picture of you and Michael Schumacher in a Mazda Miata. Is that the same one?
And I still have it. But listen, what's even a cooler story is, like, well, it's pretty cool, but they're equally as cool. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with Mary Ellen Weber. She's a skydiver from, now she lives in Paris, but she was on the space shuttle several times. She's an astronaut. And so we were really good friends, and she actually won the Airspeed Experience. And so she was doing the Airspeed Experience, and I'd always wanted a Mazda Miata, but then I had my first child, and that kind of went no Miata. And so I'd always been on the lookout for a kind of a used one to work on it. And so I was telling her that story, and so she goes, she's like, I have the most cherry Mazda Miata, because she just bought a BMW Z4, and at the time they looked very, man, they have a similar kind of lines to it. She goes, I will sell you that Mazda Miata. And that was in 2007. So she sold that to me, and at friend prices. She's awesome. And so she sold that to me, and I still have it. So that's 15 years I've had it. It was her first car. And kind of a funny side story, I was in Paris last year, and I drove the Miata there, and I saw both her and her husband Jerry, and you know, they're big, they're car guys. Jerry has like a 1980, like a Toyota, a Corolla or something from, I'm trying to think of what it, either way, he has a car, and it's still going. And so I said, you want to take it for a drive? So they got in that car, and they went off for like 45 minutes. And so she came back. She goes, hey, okay, I just have one thing to say. If you ever want to sell that, can I have first option to buy it back? So it's had, I got it from an astronaut, and it's had Michael Schumacher in there. And that was my only request from him. I never asked him for an autograph. I said, I just want a photo of you and I in this car.
I'm going to close with this question, Craig, that I am now asking all my guests, is I'm enamored by crossroads moments. Like, we are faced with a decision, and by choosing one direction, it changes the course of our lives. Describe a crossroads moment for you.
There's been many. But I'll tell you that whenever it goes, you can't go backwards, and you can't have any regret. And I've had many, and there's going to be more. When you decide to make a decision, a lot of times that decision, it has to be from your heart. Or let's say it was decided for you. Let's say it's a medical issue or something that you had not a lot of control over it. And so when it does happen, you got to make the best of that road that you're going, and with no regret. Because you can't turn around and go back to the stop sign and take a right where you took a left.
In my research of you, I look at it and go, gosh, what if Craig Girard decides not to join the Army? Where's Craig Girard today?
I don't know.
Major crossroads moment.
Yeah, I don't know, man. But I think all those life experiences help make me, including the ones where I turned left and I should have gone right. Because if I just hit rights all the time, which I feel like my life has, but it's not. It's just sometimes when something goes on, and there's been times when I was just like everybody has their own barrel, and you can be at the bottom of your own barrel, you know? And like somebody else who's at the bottom of their barrel, that barrel doesn't look like the bottom of the barrel. And I've figured out that, like, just give it some time. It may seem super, super bad right now, but time will heal, and people will love you, and you will love yourself. And man, that's the big one. You gotta forgive yourself, learn from it, and make it better.
From an 8-time world champion, that is the best advice I have heard.
Yeah, thank you.
Man, that is awesome and a great place to close. Craig, thank you. Man, what an arc, what a journey we just went through in the last 90 minutes. Man, we hit it. We didn't even come close to hitting it all, but we hit some real cool
points.
But
James, I feel like a lot of times we chat, like we've had a lot of long chats, man, and it's like I feel like we're just having a chat. But you are a fascinating guy. You're an awesome friend and inspiring. I am a big fan of everything you do, because you always do it with a smile and positive energy, man. I'm a huge fan. Thank you very much.
That means so much. Craig, thank you, man. I enjoyed that so much.
My pleasure, James.
Thanks so much for listening to the 20 Minute Call podcast. Please do follow us on your podcast app so you always have the latest episode downloaded. And leave a review if you really enjoyed the episode. If you want to contact the team, our email address is info@beyondmarketing.xyz. This episode was edited and engineered by Garnet Znydrick of the YouTube channel Blue Skies Fun Days. Thanks for listening, and join us in 2 weeks for our next episode.